Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Marc Maron has been a stand-up comedian for decades, but what made him well known are his long-form interviews with celebrities, artists, even President Obama. They're among the guests on his podcast, WTF with Marc Maron. We can't explain what WTF stands for here on the radio, but I'm sure you get the idea. Maron records the podcast in his garage in Los Angeles. Maron's IFC show, Maron, which he starred in, also had its series finale this summer after 4 seasons. He'll be doing 2 shows at the Wilbur Theater in Boston this weekend. When we spoke with Maron last week, we started by talking about the popularity of his podcasts. Because his podcasts are between 1 and 2 hours long, and the trend in broadcasting is towards shorter and shorter, we asked him why we thought his podcasts were so popular.
If you have a conversation that flows and is engaged, why wouldn't people listen? I don't know where that lack of faith came from. And just to let things pace out as they would in a conversation is something I think that people are maybe craving even in their own life. I mean, I seem to think there was a time, at least when I was younger, where, and then again, I chose a line of work that afforded me a lot of time to sit around restaurants and diners and comedy clubs talking to people. But, you know, walking around and engaging with another person for sort of free form, long conversations about whatever was a tremendous way to spend a day.
Mm. And do you sort of approach it with the thinking, I want to talk to that person because I want to shed light on that person as a human being? I want to have a really good conversation, which of course everyone does who has those kinds of conversations. But is it more about crafting a conversation? Is it more about getting to the person? Is it more topical? What's sort of your guiding principle when you're thinking of who you want to talk with, if you have one?
A lot of times it's like, you know, what's that guy been doing?
Right.
You know, or what is she up to? Or what does her life look like? Or where'd they come from? I don't, I'm not out to sandbag anybody or make anybody look bad. I'm usually out to sort of fulfill my own need to connect with people. And sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't. But ultimately, I'm looking to connect with them as people. And I think if anything happens in that garage that people really register when they're listening is, you know, people we grow to respect or idolize or appreciate their work in a general way because of movies or television or writing or directing, whatever they do, you know, our relationship with them is sort of not human. It's you know, we appreciate the work and we hear gossip or we think we know the person or we get an idea of them. But what happens when they come in there, you know, it's hard to hide for an hour. And and even if you're hiding, maybe that's a facet of your personality. So what the conversations become are sort of, you know, portraits of these people, hopefully emotional portraits of people in conversation at that time that I talk to them. And that's the best thing that can happen. It's not a matter of information, really.
Mm. You know, last year you spoke with Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live, and loyal listeners of WTF know how your meeting with Lorne Michaels decades ago haunted you, really. Now, how did you feel about that interview, and how do you feel now afterward?
I was happy that he was able to sort of address that memory of mine. You know, I had to get some closure on that. So I appreciated the fact that, you know, I went through my memory of that and he clarified things from his end or what he thought at that time. And I have to take his word. And that was definitely very helpful. And the feeling I got after mythologizing this guy and putting him up on a pedestal and assuming things about his power in show business and, you know, his power over that show, is that what I found very humanizing and almost humbling was that, you know, he's a guy that goes to that building and goes to work every day. And that to me was sort of a revelation.
So you got to feel that he was a little bit more human, and that made you feel better about what had happened years
ago?
Yeah,
man. I wasn't mad at him. And, you know, if anything, I don't think I was ready for that show, and I don't think that his decision was wrong. And, you know, and I was sort of cocky, and I had my own ideas about myself. So, of course, I'm going to kind of, you know, swagger through my own rendition of what happened for, you know, half my life and make him a villain. Yeah, I was I was happy he remembered it. And I'd like to believe he was trying to help me. And I'll take that. Whether at that moment he was or not, I'll accept the older Lorne being gracious and paternal in a way.
I want to talk about your time in Boston. You were here. And it was here in Boston where you and Louis C.K. met in the 80s, right? He tells a story in the 2010 interview about seeing you at Catch a Rising Star and saying he didn't love you so much on stage at that time. What do you think about when you look back on your time in Boston?
And then he saw me washing dishes at the Coffee Connection. He's like, oh, that guy's all right. Yeah, I mean, that was right upstairs, too. Well, you know, I went, you know, there's a lot of different times in Boston. You know, I went to college at Curry College out in Milton and for my freshman year, and that was that. And then BU. And then after college, you know, going to L.A., you know, having the first round of horrendous drug engagement, after less than a year in L.A., you know, I ran back to Boston to sort of reengage and start comedy over. And there's so many different phases of me in Boston. Mm. And I got to know New England very well because when I started working as a comic in 1988, after I came in second in the WBCN comedy riot, I lost to Sue McGinnis. You know, I started working. There were all these bars and grills and bowling alleys and discos and hotels that, you know, they'd have comedy nights. So the way I paid my dues working as a comic outside of Catch a Rising Star, which was sort of like a salon compared to the actual work you had to do, was you would get directions. You'd go to the office of the Boston Comedy Company. You'd go and Nina would give you a map. You know, and you're working for $75 and you're opening on a two-man show, a two-person show where the opener would do a half hour and the headliner would do 45. You're driving, you know, to Cranston, Rhode Island to perform at a bowling alley bar, or you're driving up to Mother Shapiro's up in Burlington at the ski area, or you're going out to Pancho Villa's in Leominster to perform under a disco ball.
But I'm not hearing real happiness there, to be quite honest.
I don't know how I did it, Deb. I don't know who that kid was. He was aggravated. He was, you know, socially different than most of those audiences. You know, I was this angry Jewish guy. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. You know, I once drove like 8 or 9 hours to Machias, Maine to open for a hypnotist at a college. But it was all I wanted to do.
You know, it just reminds me of something. There was an interview that with Billy Crystal, and he told you that he had a mantra about his career. Don't settle in. You said yours was hide the hate. Yeah, I'm wondering, like, did that kid get in the way for a long time, do you think? And you were able to resolve things that allowed you to have success? Or what happened there?
You know, my hate was a sort of, you know, a self-hatred that was projected that, you know, I assumed that the audience wouldn't like me, you know, always. I assumed walking out on stage that it was going to be trouble from the get-go. But, you know, I was also, you know, a Jewish kid that grew up with parents from New Jersey who liked Buddy Hackett and Don Rickles and Jackie Vernon and, you know, Woody Allen. You know, so somewhere along the line, my nature had sort of been steamrolled by, you know, my fear and my contempt. It took me a long time to find myself in my own body with my own heart and mind connected to what I was doing. So I, you know, settling was never really a choice for me.
Right. Why so much fear and contempt?
Well, I mean, I don't know. That's a good question for anybody, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
I don't know why I chose comedy to, you know, to find myself. You know, it seems like the most adverse thing to do that, you know, but there was something about being seen, being witnessed. You talk to a lot of comics and they go up there, you know, wanting to be loved. I think I had that, but I was going to fight it if it was coming to me. Mm. Which I think makes me a little different.
In an interview with Alan Alda, he asked you if you have kids, and you said no. When you're 52 years old and you don't have children, someone's right. What did you mean by that?
I said that. Well, look, you know, it just wasn't. You know, I've been married twice, and I don't know. You know, if it's unhealthy or healthy or what, but whatever my parents did, however I brought up, I have a certain amount of anxiety and self-centeredness. I never thought about it. Yeah, it's hard for me just with cats. I panic, if they're not eating. I don't feel that there's a void in my life. Maybe I will another time, but I'm not wired that way, and I'm okay with it.
You decided to end your IFC show, Marin, after four seasons this year. Why is that?
Well, how many do you need to do? You know what I mean? I don't need the money. So the truth was is that we had told all the stories, and we did three seasons, that were directly based on my life, and one sort of season that was a cautionary tale and sort of a darker exploration of the possibilities of addiction and losing success. I felt like we had a nice end to it, and I thought the story was nice, the arc was nice, and I loved the way it ended. And I don't need to do things I don't want to do.
Well, I want to just talk a little bit more about that dark cautionary tale, where in season four, when a back injury leads to an addiction to painkillers. It's a big deal right now nationally. But why did you want to get into that on the show? And is that something that you worry about personally, right, after 17 years of sobriety yourself? Is that right?
Right. Well, I mean, I feel pretty grounded in my sobriety, but certainly, being a guy who does recovery, you do see it happen, and that's usually how it happens. So to sort of depart from my real life narrative a bit and explore that was good for me to see how easy it happens, and also it was interesting to go explore the idea of having something and then having absolutely nothing. The whole life of an addict, when that happens, no matter when it happens and what happens to your life, is profound and horrible. I just wanted to honor that somehow. I wanted to, why build this world where I just podcast and, have problems with women and whatever. We didn't need to honor that. We were on IFC. We could do whatever we wanted. So when the idea came, that I relapse, I was like, this is amazing. Like, I didn't even know if I was going to do a fourth season. And then I sort of had this epiphany that if we can do it where it's like three different shows where, I'm strung out and I got to get clean and then I got to figure out how to transition into life. And then I change my life drastically. Like, if we could break it down like that, it would be a very challenging and exciting thing to do. But for me, it was an exploration of something that is very possible. I'm not personally afraid of relapsing, but I am, deeply afraid of drugs and alcohol. And, I'm pretty, I know in my heart and my mind that I can't do them. But again, it happens. I see it happen. I see cats with, 20 years sober, decide that they can, try it again, or they get strung out because of an injury.
Mm. So is sobriety still a struggle for you, or what do you think is the key for you to being successful?
No, sobriety is not really a struggle. I just make sure that, I do a bit of the work around it, staying, I don't have any desire to drink or do drugs, but, I get a little crazy sometimes, so I got to check in with the secret society, and I still actively, engage with that. I talk to sober people all the time. I have sober friends. I have a sponsor that I talk to. The key to success for me, I don't know. It came around the side. I didn't know. I didn't, when I started the podcast, I didn't think it was going to happen. I just needed to stay active.
Mm. Now, I've read that you don't like talking about politics, but you did mention on the podcast that talking about politics on stage and hearing in yourself a tone of intensity and anger was one that you used in your stand-up when you were younger. But, we're also in the midst of a contentious presidential election. Is it tough to stay away from politics or not really?
I've been doing a bit on stage. I don't want to use the podcast that much for a platform of that. But I've been talking about politics for a bit of my act. I try to be as empathetic as possible to those that are wrong-minded. And then it becomes an opinion anyways. I just find it all very embarrassing for a lot of reasons and very frightening for other reasons. But I do have a certain amount of faith in democracy and humanity. I'm not as cynical as people think, but I'm not thrilled with the environment of information, if that's a nice way to put it. Hmm. That, you know, there's this capacity now for people to be so fragmented because we really share so little of the same information that, you know, is even, you know, necessarily journalistic.
You know, you talked about this polarization with President Obama when you spoke with him last year. I think there was a lot of that in there about the fragmentation of media and sort of the echo chamber that people can get themselves into without really getting any information. Was that what was that interview like? And what was your ultimate goal, do you think, in talking with him?
My goal was to talk to the guy. You know, my research was very specific. I read his first book before he had presidential aspirations, certainly, which was a book about his struggle with, you know, his purpose in life and his own identity, racially and otherwise. And I thought, well, that guy's got to still be in there. And it would be interesting to talk to him. I knew that it was going to be a risk to stay away from politics, but I had an hour. And his agenda, as he stated on the show, was to get people involved in politics. And I learned that during the show. I mean, obviously, I knew that he made a choice to talk to me for a reason. He was looking for an audience of a certain type, and it was my audience, and the event was the event. But I found that, you know, very quickly I was, you know, calling him man and, you know, and finishing his sentences for him. So there was a comfort level that was achieved, and I'll have to give him the credit for that. And what I like about him a lot is that he's not the guy, you know, if you walked into a party with a lot of people and Barack Obama was there before he was president, you know, he's not going to be the guy that everyone's, you know, rallying around to listen to stories. You know, he's not a raconteur. He's not a, you know, like he's not this obsequious, charming, handshaker. You know, he's a thinky guy. I mean, I would think that if you went into a room before he was president and he was there, you'd be like, is that guy okay? What's he thinking about? You know what I mean?
So do you think you would have had all of these successes if you hadn't started the podcast?
No way. Huh. No way. And yeah, it all came from that, you know, moment of desperation to do something without a plan, without any idea of how it would make money. I had no gigs to plug. There was no way to make money, but I knew I just had to keep talking and doing something. So it wasn't even a Hail Mary pass. It was just me avoiding slipping into the darkness in all that that implies. You know, the podcast really does better for me, you know, as a job than any of the other things at this point. So I'm being afforded the opportunity to really do everything I wanted to do as a young comic, you know, which is television and a bit and have an audience as a comic. You know, it's not massive, but it's manageable for me, and it's better in that sense. So, you know, I do have fantasies of, it's weird. I do have fantasies of doing nothing.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't sound like you have a personality that could do nothing.
People say that, but I wonder. I mean, you know, nothing doesn't mean I won't be doing anything, but not like there. Like the beautiful thing about where I'm at now is that, you know, there are a lot of elements of my self-esteem have been sort of, kind of filled in a lot of the holes there because of, you know, you work 20, 25 years at something. It's nice to connect and do something that people enjoy and get a lot out of and seems, you know, relevant to people. I like, hopefully I can begin to enjoy it because I still seem to make myself pretty crazy.
Oh, right. I wonder if it's almost difficult. Do you say, okay, is this it?
Well, that's not what I think. What I think is like, you know, the other shoe's going to drop or I'm a fraud. Like, there's no sort of like, yeah, I'm here. You know, I would welcome that for 10 minutes. For me, because of my anxiety and just the way I'm wired, you know, my brain would much rather be filled with panic and dread than excitement. And they're very similar. It's a very slight adjustment.
Okay, Mark Maron, comedian and host of the popular podcast WTF with Mark Maron. His IFC show, Maron, which he starred in, had its series finale this summer after 4 seasons. He'll be doing 2 shows at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, Saturday, September 24th. For more information, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. Mark Maron, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And before we end today, just a reminder to our listeners, tomorrow we'll be back at the McCormick Graduate School at UMass Boston for the second in our series of live debates on the ballot questions before Massachusetts voters this November. Tuesday's debate is about question 3, which proposes to limit confinement of some farm animals. We'll have the leading voices on both sides, and Joshua Miller of the Boston Globe is our co-moderator. If you want to attend, go to wbur.org/events. Tickets are limited, and you can listen live tomorrow at 3 here on 90.9 WBUR, or you can watch the video stream at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.